The most obvious example of this would be the tale of the flying chair of the widow's son. Among the mountain folk, the bucktail becomes the flying sled of the orphan boy. Who can tell which telling was first? The folk of the mountain kingdom will tell you that that ancient race is responsible for some of the more peculiar monuments that one may chance upon in their forests. They are also credited with lesser achievements, such as some of the games of strategy that mountain children still play, and for a very peculiar wind instrument, powered not by a man's lungs, but by breath, trapped in an inflated bladder. Tales are also told of ancient cities, far back in the mountains, that were once the dwelling of these beings. But nowhere in all their literature, spoken or written, have I found any account of how these people ceased to be. 3 days later, we reached the quarry. We had had 3 days of hiking through suddenly hot weather. The air had been full of the scents of opening leaves and flowers, and the whistles of birds and the drones of insects. To either side of the Skill Road, life burgeoned. I walked through it, senses keen, more aware of being alive than I had ever been. The fool had spoken no more about whatever he had foreseen for me. For that I was grateful. I had found Night Eyes was right, knowing it was hard enough. I would not dwell on it. Then we came to the quarry. At first it seemed to us that we had simply come to a dead end. The road ramped down into a worked gorge of bare stone, an area twice the size of Buckkeep Castle. The walls of the valley were vertically straight and bare, scarred where immense blocks of black stone had been quarried from it. In a few places, cascading greenery from the earth at the edge of the quarry covered the sheared rock sides. At the lower end of the pit, rainwater had collected and stagnated greenly. There was little other vegetation, for there was precious little soil. Beneath our feet, past the end of the Skill Road, we stood on the raw black stone the road had been wrought from. When we looked up at the looming cliff across from us, black stone veined with silver met our eyes. On the floor of the quarry, a number of immense blocks had been abandoned amidst piles of rubble and dust. The huge blocks were bigger than buildings. I could not imagine how they had been cut, let alone how they would have been hauled away. Beside them were the remains of great machines, reminding me somewhat of siege engines. Their wood had rotted, their metal rusted, their remains hunched together like mouldering bones. Silence brimmed the quarry. Two things about the place immediately caught my attention. The first was the black pillar that reared up in our pathway, incised with the same ancient runes we had encountered before. The second was the absolute absence of animal life. I came to a halt by the pillar. I quested out, and the wolf shared my searching. Cold stone. Perhaps we shall learn to eat rocks now? The wolf suggested. We shall have to do our hunting elsewhere tonight. I agreed.
And find clean water, added the fool.
Kedrickin had stopped by the pillar. The Jeppers were already straying away, searching disconsolately for anything green. Possessing the skill and the wit sharpened my perceptions of other folk, but for the moment I sensed nothing from her. Her face was still and empty. A slackness came over it, as if she aged before my eyes. Her eyes wandered over the lifeless stone and by chance turned to me. A sickly smile spread over her mouth.
"He's not here," she said. "We've come all this way, and he isn't here."
I could think of nothing to say to her. Of all the things I might have expected at the end of our quest, an abandoned stone quarry seemed unlikeliest. I tried to think of something optimistic to say. There was nothing. This was the last location marked on our map, and evidently the final destination of the skill road as well. She sank down slowly to sit flat on the stone at the pillar's base. She just sat there, too weary and discouraged to weep. When I looked to Kettle and Starling, I found them staring at me, as if I was supposed to have an answer. I did not. The heat of the warm day pressed down on me. For this, we had come so far.
I smell carrion.
I don't. It was the last thing I wanted to think about just now.
I didn't expect you would, with your nose, but there is something very dead not far from here.
So go roll in it and have done with it. I told him with some asperity.
It's...
Kettle rebuked me as Night Eyes trotted purposefully away. I was talking to the wolf. I told her lamely. The fool nodded, almost vacantly. He had not been at all himself. Kettle had insisted that he continue taking the elf bark, though our small supply limited him to a very weak dose of the same bark brewed over again. From time to time I thought I caught a brief hint of the skill bond between us. If I looked at him, he would sometimes turn and return my look, even across camp. It was little more than that. When I spoke of it to him, he said he sometimes felt something, but he was not sure what it was. Of what the wolf had told me, I made no mention. Elf bark tea or no, he remained solemn and lethargic. His sleep at night did not seem to rest him. He moaned or muttered through his dreams. He reminded me of a man recovering from a long illness. He hoarded his strength in many small ways. He spoke little. Even his bitter merriment had vanished. It was but one more worry for me to bear.
It is a man.
The stench of the corpse was thick in Night Eye's nostrils. I nearly retched with it. Then,
Verity,
I whispered to myself in horror. I set out at a run in the direction the wolf had taken. The fool followed, more slowly in my wake, drifting, like down on the wind. The women watched us go without comprehension. The body was wedged between two immense blocks of stone. It was huddled, as if even in death it sought to hide. The wolf circled it restlessly, hackles up. I halted at some distance, then tugged the cuff of my shirt down over my hand. I lifted it to cover my nose and mouth. It helped a bit. But nothing could have completely drowned that stink. I walked closer, steeling myself to what I knew I must do. When I got close to the body, I reached down, seized hold of its rich cloak, and dragged it out into the open.
No flies,
the fool observed almost dreamily. He was right. There were no flies, and no maggots. Only the silent rot of death had been at work on the man's features. They were dark, like a ploughman's tan, only darker. Fear had contorted them, but I knew it was not Verity. Yet I had stared at him for some moments before I recognized him.
Carrad, I said quietly.
A member of Regal's coterie?
The fool asked, as if there could be another Carrad about. I nodded. I kept my shirt cuff over my nose and mouth as I knelt beside him.
How did he die?
The fool asked. The smell did not seem to bother him, but I did not think I could speak without gagging. I shrugged. To answer, I would have had to take a breath. I reached gingerly to tug at his clothes. The body was both stiff and softening. It was hard to examine it, but I could find no sign of any violence on him. I took a shallow breath and held it. Then used both hands to unbuckle his belt. I pulled it free of the body with his purse and knife still on it, and hastily retreated with it. Kettricken, Kettle, and Starling came up on us as I was coaxing the mouth of his purse open. I did not know what I had hoped to find, but I was disappointed. A handful of coins, a flint, and a small whetstone were all he carried. I tossed it to the ground and rubbed my hand down my trouser leg. The stench of death clung to it.
"It was carried,"
the fool told the others.
"He must have come by the pillar." "What killed him?"
Kettle asked. I met her gaze. "I don't know. I believe it was the skill. Whatever it was, he tried to hide from it, between those rocks. Let's get away from this smell," I suggested. We retreated back to the pillar. Night Eyes and I came last, and more slowly. I was puzzled. I realized I was putting everything I could into keeping my skill walls strong. Seeing Carrad dead had shocked me. One less coterie member, I told myself, but he was here, right here, in the quarry, when he died. If Verity had killed him with the skill, perhaps that meant Verity had been here as well. I wondered if we would stumble across Burl and Will somewhere in the quarry, if they too had come here to attack Verity. Colder was my suspicion that it was more likely we would find Verity's body. But I said nothing to Ketrickin of these thoughts. I think the wolf and I sensed it at the same time. "There is something alive back there," I said quietly. "Deeper in the quarry."
"What is it?"
the fool asked me. "I don't know." A shivering ran all over me. My wit sense of whatever was back there ebbed and flowed. The more I tried for a feel of what it was, the more it eluded me.
"Verity?"
Ketrickin asked. It broke my heart to see hope quicken once more in her eyes. "No," I told her gently. "I don't think so. It doesn't feel like a human. It's like nothing I've ever sensed before." I paused and added, "I think you should all wait here while the wolf and I go see what it is."
"No,"
Kettle spoke, "not Ketrickin." But when I glanced back at my queen, I saw her complete agreement.
"If anything, I should have you and the fool hang back while we investigate," she told me severely. "You are the ones at risk here. If Carrad has been here, Burl and Will could be back there."
In the end, it was decided we would all approach, but with great caution. We spread out in a fan and moved forward across the quarry floor. I could not tell them specifically where I had sensed the creature, and so we were all on edge. The quarry was like a nursery floor with some immense child's blocks and toys scattered across it. We passed one partially carved block of stone. It had none of the finesse of the carvings we had seen in the stone garden. It was lumpish and crude, and somehow obscene. It reminded me of the fetus of a miscarried foal. It repulsed me, and I slipped past it as quickly as I could to my next vantage point. The others were doing likewise, moving from cover to cover, all of us endeavoring to keep at least one other of our party in sight. I had thought I could see nothing more disturbing than that crude stone carving. But the next one we passed wrenched at me. Someone had carved, in heartbreaking detail, a mired dragon.
The thing's wings were half spread, and its half-lidded eyes were rolled up in agony. A human rider. A young woman bestrode it.
She clutched the undulant neck and leaned her cheek against it. Her face was a mask of agony, her mouth open and the lines of her face taut, the muscles of her throat standing out like cords. Both the girl and the dragon had been worked in detailed colors and lines. I could see the woman's eyelashes, the individual hairs on her golden head, the fine green scales about the dragon's eyes, even the droplets of saliva that clung to the dragon's writhing lips. But where the dragon's mighty feet and lashing tail should have been, there was only puddled black stone, as if the two had landed in a tar pit and been unable to escape it. Just as a statue, it was wrenching. I saw Kettle turn her face aside from it, tears starting in her eyes. But what unnerved Night Eyes and me was the writhing of wit sense that it gave off. It was fainter than what we had sensed in the statues back in the garden, but all the more poignant for that. It was like the final death throes of a trapped creature. I wondered what talent had been used to infuse such a living nuance into a statue. Even as I appreciated the artistry of what had been done, I was not sure I approved of it. But that was true of much that this ancient skilled race had wrought. As I crept past the statue, I wondered if this was what the wolf and I had sensed. It prickled my skin to see the fool turn and stare back at it, his brow furrowed in discomfort. Plainly, he sensed it, though not as well. Perhaps this is what we sensed, Night Eyes. Perhaps there is no living creature in the quarry after all, only this monument to slow death.
No, I smell something.
I widened my nostrils, cleared them with a silent snort, then took in a deep, slow breath of air. My nose was not as keen as Night Eyes, but the wolf's senses augmented my own. I smelled sweat and the faint tang of blood. Both were fresh. Suddenly the wolf pressed close to me, and as one we slunk around the end of a block of stone, the size of two huts. I peered around the corner, then cautiously crept forth. Night Eyes slipped past me. I saw the fool around the other end of the stone, and felt the others drawing near as well. No one spoke. It was another dragon. This one, the size of a ship. It was all of black stone, and it sprawled sleeping upon the block of stone it was emerging from. Chips and chunks and grindings of rock dust surrounded the ground around the block. Even from a distance it impressed me. Despite its sleep, every line of the creature spoke of both strength and nobility. The wings folded alongside it were like furled sails, while the arch of the powerful neck put me in mind of a battle charger. I had looked at it for some moments before I saw the small grey figure that sprawled alongside it. I stared at him and tried to decide if the flickering life I sensed came from him or the stone dragon. The discarded fragments of stone were almost a ramp up to the block the dragon was emerging from. I thought the figure would stir to my crunching footsteps, but he did not move, nor could I detect any small motions of breath. The others hung back, watching my ascent. Only Night Eyes accompanied me, and he came, hackles abristle. I was within arm's reach of the figure, when he jerkily arose and faced me. He was old and thin, grey of both hair and beard. His ragged garments were grey with stone dust, and a smear of grey coated one of his cheeks. The knees that showed through the legs of his trousers were scabbed and bloody from kneeling on broken stone. His feet were wrapped in rags. He gripped a much-notched sword in a grey gauntleted hand, but he did not bring it up to the ready. I felt it taxed his strength to hold the blade at all. Some instinct made me lift my arms wide of my body to show him I held no weapon. He looked at me dully for a bit, then he slowly lifted his eyes to my face. For a time we stared at one another. His peering, near-blind gaze reminded me of Harper Josh. Then his mouth gaped wide in his beard, bearing surprisingly white teeth.
"Fitz?"
he said hesitantly. I knew his voice, despite the rust. He had to be Verity. But all I was, cried out aghast, that he could have come to this wreckage of a man. Behind me, I heard the swift crunching of footsteps and turned in time to see Ketrickin charging up the ramp of crumbling stone. Hope and dismay battled in her face, yet, "Verity!"
she cried. And there was only love in the word. She charged, arms reaching for him, and I was barely able to catch her as she hurtled past me. "No!" I cried aloud to her. "No, don't touch him!"
"Verity!"
she cried again, and then struggled against my grip, crying out, "Let me go! Let me go to him!" It was all I could do to hold her back.
"No,"
I told her quietly. As sometimes happens, the softness of my command made her stop struggling. She looked her question at me.
"His hands and arms are covered with magic. I do not know what would happen to you were he to touch you."
She turned her head in my rough embrace to stare at her husband. He stood watching us, a kindly, rather confused smile on his face. He tilted his head to one side as if considering us, then stooped carefully to set down his sword. Ketrikin saw then what I had glimpsed before. The betraying shimmer of silver crawled over his forearms and fingers. Verity wore no gauntlets. The flesh of his arms and hands were impregnated with raw power. The smudge on his face was not dust, but a smear of power where he had touched himself. I heard the others come up behind us, their footsteps crunching slowly over the stone. I did not need to turn to feel them staring. Finally, the fool said softly,
"Verity, my prince, we have come."
I heard a sound between a gasp and a sob. That turned my head, and I saw Kettle slowly settling, going down like a whole ship. She clasped one hand to her chest and one to her mouth as she sank to her knees. Her eyes goggled as she stared at Verity's hands. Starling was instantly beside her. In my arms I felt Ketrikin calmly push against me. I looked at her stricken face, then let her go. She advanced to Verity a slow step at a time, and he watched her come. His face was not impassive, but neither did he show any sign of special recognition. An arm's length away from him, she stopped. All was silence. She stared at him for a time, then slowly shook her head as if to answer the question she voiced.
"My lord husband, do you not know me?"
"Husband,"
he said faintly. His brow creased deeper, his demeanor that of a man who recalls something once learned by rote.
"Princess Ketrikin of the Mountain Kingdom. She was given me to wife. Just a little slip of a girl, a wild little mountain cat, yellow-haired. That was all I could recall of her until they brought her to me."
A faint smile eased his face.
"That night I unbound golden hair like a flowing stream, finer than silk. So fine I durst not touch it, lest it snag in my calloused hands."
Ketrikin's hands rose to her hair. When word had reached her of Verity's death, she had cut her hair to no more than a brush on her skull. It now reached almost to her shoulders, but the fine silk of it was gone, roughened by sun and rain and road dust. But she freed it from the fat braid that confined it and shook it loose around her face.
"My lord,"
she said softly. She glanced from me to Verity.
"May I not touch you?"
she begged.
"Oh."
He seemed to consider the request. He glanced down at his arms and hands, flexing his silvery fingers.
"Oh, I think not, I'm afraid. No. No, it were better not."
He spoke regretfully, but I had the sense that it was only that he must refuse her request, not that he regretted being unable to touch her. Ketrikin drew a ragged breath.
"My lord,"
she began. And then her voice broke.
"Verity, I lost our child. Our son died."
I did not understand until then what a burden it had been for her,
seeking for her husband, knowing she must tell him this news. She dropped her proud head as if expecting his wrath. What she got was worse.
Oh,
he said. Then, had we a son?
I do not recall.
I think that was what broke her. To discover that her earth-shaking tidings did not anger nor sorrow him, but only confused him. She had to feel betrayed. Her desperate flight from Buckkeep Castle, and all the hardships she had endured to protect her unborn child, the long, lonely months of her pregnancy, culminating in the heart-rending stillbirth of her child, and her dread that she must tell her lord how she had failed him. That had been her reality for the past year. And now she stood before her husband and her king, and he fumbled to recall her. And of the dead child said only, "Oh." I felt shamed for this doddering old man who peered at the queen and smiled so wearily. Ketrickin did not scream or weep. She simply turned and walked slowly away. I sensed great control in that passage, and great anger. Starling, crouched by Kettle, looked up at the queen as she passed. She started to rise and follow, but Ketrickin made a tiny movement of her hand that forbade it. Alone, she descended from the great stone dais and strode off.
Go with her,
please.
But do not bother her. I am not stupid.
Night Eyes left me to shadow off after Ketrickin. Despite my caution to him, I knew he went straight to her, to come up beside her and press his great head against her leg. She dropped suddenly to one knee and hugged him, pushing her face against his coat, her tears falling into his rough fur. He turned and licked her hand.
"Go away,"
he chided me, and I pulled my awareness back from them. I blinked, realizing I had been staring at Verity all the while. His eyes met mine. He cleared his throat.
"Fifth Chivalry,"
he said, and drew a breath to speak. Then he let half of it out.
"I am so weary,"
he said piteously,
"and there is still so much to do."
He gestured at the dragon behind him. Ponderously he sank to sit beside the statue.
"I tried so hard,"
he said to no one in particular. The fool recovered his senses before I did mine.
"My Lord Prince Verity,"
he began, then paused.
"My king, it is I, the fool. May I be of service to you?"
Verity looked up at the slender, pale man who stood before him.
"I would be honored,"
he said after a moment. His head swayed on his neck.
"To accept the fealty and service of one who served both my father and my queen so well."
For an instant, I glimpsed something of the old Verity. Then the certainty flickered out of his face again. The fool advanced and then knelt suddenly beside him. He patted Verity on the shoulder, sending up a small cloud of rock dust.
"I will take care of you," he said, "as I did your father."
He stood up suddenly and turned to me.
"I am going to fetch firewood and find clean water," he announced.
He glanced past me to the women.
"Is Kettle all right?"
he asked Starling.
"She nearly fainted," Starling began,
but Kettle cut in abruptly with,
"I was shocked to my core, fool, and I'm in no hurry to stand up, but Starling is free to go do whatever must be done." "Ah, good."
The fool appeared to have taken complete control of the situation. He sounded as if he were organizing tea.
"Then, if you would be so kind, Mr. Starling, would you see to the setting up of the tent? Or two tents, if such a thing can be contrived. See what food we have left and plan a meal, a generous meal, for I think we all need it. I shall return shortly with firewood and water."
And greens, if I am lucky.
He cast a quick look at me.
See to the king,
he said in a low voice. Then he strode away. Starling was left gaping. Then she arose and went in search of the straying Jeppas. Kettle followed her more slowly.
And so, after all that time and travel, I was left standing alone before my king.
Come to me,
he had told me. And I had. There was an instant of peace in realizing that that nagging voice was finally stilled.
Well, I am here, my king,
I said quietly to myself, as much as to him. Verity made no reply. He had turned his back to me and was busy digging at the statue with his sword. He knelt, clutching the sword by the pommel and by the blade, and scraped the tip along the stone at the edge of the dragon's foreleg. I stepped close to watch him scratching at the black rock of the dais. His face was so intent, his movement so precise, that I did not know what to make of it.
Verity, what are you doing?
I asked softly. He did not even glance up at me.
Carving a dragon,
he replied. Several hours later he still toiled at the same task, the monotonous scrape, scrape, scrape of the blade against the stone set my teeth on edge and shredded every nerve in my body. I had remained on the dais with him. Starling and Fool had set up our tent, and a second, smaller one cobbled together from our now excess winter blankets. A fire was burning. Kettle presided over a bubbling pot. The Fool was sorting the greens and roots he had gathered while Starling arranged bedding in the tents. Kedrigan had rejoined us briefly, but only to get her bow and quiver from the Jeppa's packs. She had announced she was going hunting with Night Eyes. He had given me one lambent glance from his dark eyes, and I had held my tongue. I knew but little more than I had when we had first found Verity. His skill walls were high and tight. I received almost no sense of the skill from him. What I discovered when I quested toward him was even more unnerving. I grasped the fluttering wit sense I had of him, but could not understand it. It was as if his life and awareness fluctuated between his body and the great statue of the dragon. I recalled the last time I had encountered such a thing. It had been between the Witman and his bear. They had shared the same flowing of life. I suspected that if anyone had quested toward the wolf in me, they would discover the same sort of pattern. We had shared minds for so long that in some ways we were one creature. But that did not explain to me how Verity could have bonded with a statue, nor why he persisted in scraping at it with his sword. I longed to grab hold of the sword and snatch it from his grasp. But I refrained. In truth, he seemed so obsessed with what he did that I almost feared to interrupt him. Earlier I had tried asking him questions. When I asked him what had become of those who left with him, he had shaken his head slowly.
They harried us as a flock of crows will haunt an eagle, coming close, squawking and pecking, and fleeing when we turned to attack them.
Crows? I had asked him blankly. He shook his head at my stupidity.
Hired soldiers. They shot at us from cover. They came at us at night sometimes, and some of my men were baffled by the coterie's skill. I could not shield the minds of those who were susceptible. Night fears they sent to stalk them, and suspicion of one another. So I bid them go back. I pressed my own skill command into their minds to save them from any other.
It was almost the only question he truly answered. Of the others I asked, he did not choose to answer many, and the answers he did give were either inappropriate or evasive.
So I gave it up.
Instead, I found myself reporting to him. It was a long accounting, for I began with the day I had watched him ride away. Much of what I told him I was sure he already knew. But I repeated it anyway.
If his mind was wandering as I feared, it might anchor him to refresh his memory. And if my king's mind was as sharp as ever beneath this dusty demeanour, then it could not hurt for all the events to be put in perspective and order. I could think of no other way to reach him. I had begun it, I think, to try to make him realize all we had gone through to be here. Also, I wished to awaken him to what was happening in his kingdom while he loitered here with his dragon. Perhaps I hoped to waken him some sense of responsibility for his folk again. As I spoke, he seemed dispassionate, but occasionally he would nod gravely, as if I had confirmed some secret fear of his. And all that time, the sword tip moved against the black stone, scrape, scrape, scrape. It was on the verge of full dark when I heard the scuff of Kettle's footsteps behind me. I paused in recounting my adventures in the ruined city, and turned to look at her.
"I've brought you both some hot tea," she announced.
"Thank you," I said, and took my mug from her. But Verity only glanced up from his perpetual scraping. For a time, Kettle stood proffering the cup to Verity. When she spoke, it was not to remind him of tea.
"What are you doing?"
she asked in a gentle voice. The scraping stopped abruptly. He turned to stare at her, then glanced at me as if to see if I, too, had heard her ridiculous question. The querying look I wore seemed to amaze him. He cleared his throat.
"I am carving a dragon."
"With your sword blade?"
she asked. In her tone was curiosity. No more.
"Only the rough parts," he told her. "For the finer work, I use my knife. And then, for finest of all, my fingers and nails."
He turned his head slowly, surveying the immense stone.
"I would like to say it is nearly done,"
he said falteringly.
"But how can I say that when there is still so much to do, so very much to do? And I fear it will all be too late. If it is not already too late."
"Too late for what?" I asked him, my voice as gentle as Kettle's had been.
"Why, too late to save the folk of the six duchies."
He peered at me as if I was simple.
"Why else would I be doing it? Why else would I leave my land and my queen to come here?"
I tried to grasp what he was telling me, but one overwhelming question popped out of my mouth. "You believe you have carved this whole dragon?"
Verity considered. "No, of course not."
But just as I felt relief that he was not completely mad, he added,
"It's not finished yet."
He looked again over his dragon with the fondly proud look he had once reserved for his best maps.
"But even this much has taken me a long time, a very long time."
"Won't you drink your tea while it's hot, sir?"
Kettle asked, once more proffering the cup. Verity looked at it as if it were a foreign object. Then he took it gravely from her hand.
"Tea. I had almost forgotten about tea. Not elf bark, is it? Eda's mercy, how I hated that bitter brew."
Kettle almost winced to hear him speak of it.
"No, sir, no elf bark, I promise you. It is made from wayside herbs, I am afraid, mostly nettle, and a bit of mint."
"Nettle tea. My mother used to give us nettle tea as a spring tonic."
He smiled to himself.
"I will put that in my dragon, my mother's nettle tea."
He took a sip of it, and then looked startled.
"It's warm." "It has been so long since I had time to eat anything warm." "How long?"
Kettle asked him conversationally.
Long time,"
Verity said. He took another sip of the tea.
"There are fish in a stream outside the quarry, but it is hard enough to take time to catch them, let alone cook them. Actually, I forget. I've put so many things into the dragon. Perhaps that was one of them. And how long since you slept?
Kettle pressed him.
I cannot both work and sleep,
he pointed out to her.
And the work must be done. And the work shall be done,
she promised him.
But tonight you will pause just for a bit to eat and drink. And then to sleep. See, look down there. Starling has made you a tent, and within it will be warm. Soft bedding and warmed water to wash yourself, and such fresh clothing as we can manage.
He looked down at his silvered hands.
I do not know if I can wash myself,
he confided to her.
Then Fitz Chivalry and the Fool will help you,
she promised him blithely.
Thank you, that would be good, but... His eyes went afar for a time. Ketriken. Was she not here a while ago, or did I dream her? So much of her was what was strongest, so I put it into the dragon. I think that is what I have missed the most, of all I have put there.
He paused and then added,
At the times when I can recall what I miss.
Ketriken is here, I assured him. She has gone hunting, but she will return soon. Would you like to be washed and freshly clothed when she returns? I had privately resolved to respond to the parts of his conversation that made sense, and not upset him by questioning the other parts.
That one sees past such things,
he told me, a shade of pride in his voice.
Still, it would be nice. But there is so much work to do.
But it is getting too dark to work any more today. Wait until tomorrow. It will get done,
Kettle assured him.
Tomorrow I will help you.
Verity shook his head slowly. He sipped more of the tea. Even that thin beverage seemed to be strengthening him.
No,
he said quietly.
I am afraid you cannot. I must do it myself, you see.
Tomorrow you will see. I think if you have strength enough by then it may be possible for me to help you. But we shall not worry about it until then.
He sighed and offered the empty mug back to her. Instead, she quickly gripped his upper arm and drew him to his feet. She was strong for such an old woman. She did not seek to take the sword from his grasp, but he let it fall. I stooped to gather it up. He followed Kettle, docilely, as if her simple act of taking his arm had deprived him of all will. As I followed, I ran my eyes down the blade that had been Hod's pride. I wondered what had possessed Verity to take such a kingly weapon and turn it into a rock-carving tool. The edges were turned and notched from the misuse, the tip no more pointed than a spoon. The sword was much like the man, I reflected, and followed them down to the camp. When we got down to the fireside, I was almost shocked to see that Ketriken had returned. She sat by the fire, staring dispassionately into it. Nighteyes lay almost across her feet, his ears pricked toward me as I approached the fire, but he made no move to leave the queen. Kettle guided Verity directly to the makeshift tent that had been pitched for him. She nodded to the fool, and without a word he took up a steaming basin of water from beside the fire and followed her. When I ventured to enter the tiny tent also, the fool shooed both me and Kettle away.
"He will not be the first king I have tended to," he reminded us. "Trust him to me. Touch not his hands nor forearms,"
Kettle warned him sternly. The fool looked a bit taken aback by that, but after a moment he gave a bobbing nod of agreement. When I left, he was untying the much-knotted thong that closed Verity's worn jerkin, speaking all the while of inconsequential things. I heard Verity observe,
"I have missed Charim so. I should never have let him come with me, but he had served me so long. He died slowly,
with much pain. That was hard for me, watching him die, but he, too, has gone into the dragon. It was necessary.
I felt awkward when I returned to the fire. Starling was stirring the pot of stew that was bubbling merrily. A large chunk of meat, on a spit, was dripping fat into the fire, making the flames leap and hiss. The smell of it reminded me of my hunger, so that my belly growled. Kettle was standing, her back to the fire, staring off into darkness. Ketrikin's eyes flickered toward me. "So," I said suddenly, "how was the hunting?"
"As you see,"
Ketrikin said softly. She gestured to the pot, and then tossed a hand casually to indicate a butchered-out wood sow. I stepped over to admire it. It was not a small animal. "Dangerous prey," I observed, trying to sound casual rather than horrified that my queen would take on such a beast alone.
"It was what I needed to hunt,"
she said, her voice still soft. I understood her only too well.
"It was very good hunting. Never have I taken so much meat with so little effort,"
Night Eyes told me. He rubbed the side of his head against her leg in true affection. She dropped a hand to pull gently at his ears. He groaned in pleasure and leaned heavily against her. "You'll spoil him," I mock warned her. "He tells me he has never taken so much meat with so little effort."
"He is so intelligent."
"I swear he drove the game toward me, and he has courage. When my first arrow did not drop her, he held her at bay while I knocked another one to my bow."
She spoke as if she had nothing else on her mind but this. I nodded to her words, content to let our conversation be thus. But she suddenly asked me,
"What is wrong with him?"
I knew she did not speak of the wolf.
"I am not sure," I said gently. "He has known a great deal of privation, perhaps enough to weaken his mind, and—"
"No."
Kettle's voice was brusque.
"That is not it at all. Though I will grant you he is weary, any man would be, to do what he has done alone, but—"
"You cannot believe he has carved that whole dragon himself," I interrupted her.
"I do,"
the old woman replied with certainty.
"It is as I told you. He must do it himself, and so he has done it."
She shook her head slowly.
"Never have I heard such a thing. Even King Wisdom had the help of his coterie, or what was left of it, when he reached here."
"No one could have carved that statue with a sword," I said stubbornly. What she was saying was nonsense. For answer, she rose and stalked off into the darkness. When she returned, she dropped two objects at my feet. One had been a chisel. Once. Its head was peened over into a lump, its blade gone to nothing. The other was an ancient iron mallet head, with a relatively new wooden handle set into it.
"There are others, scattered about. He probably found them in the city, or discarded hereabouts,"
she observed, before I could ask the question. I stared at the battered tools, and considered all the months that Verity had been gone for this? For the carving of a stone dragon?
"I don't understand,"
I said faintly. Kettle spoke clearly, as if I were slow.
"He has been carving a dragon, and storing all his memories in it. That is part of why he seems so vague, but there is more. I believe he used the skill to kill Carid, and has taken grievous hurt in doing so."
She shook her head sadly.
"To have come so close to finishing and then to be defeated. I wonder how sly Regal's coterie is. Did they send one against him, knowing that if Verity killed with the skill, he might defeat himself? I do not think any of that coterie would willingly sacrifice himself."
Kettle smiled bitterly.
I did not say he was willingly sent, nor did I say he knew what his fellows intended. It is like the game of stones, fit chivalry. One plays each stone to best advantage in the game. The object is to win, not to hoard one's stones.
34. Girl on a Dragon. Early in our resistance to the Red Ships, before anyone in the Six Duchies had begun to call it a war, King Shrewd and Prince Verity realized that the task facing them was overwhelming. No individual man, no matter how skilled, could stand alone to fend the Red Ships from our coasts. King Shrewd summoned before him Galen the Skillmaster and directed him to create for Verity a coterie to aid the prince's efforts. Galen resisted this idea, especially when he found that one of those he must train was a royal bastard. The Skillmaster declared that none of the students presented to him were worthy of training. But King Shrewd insisted, telling him to make the best of them that he could. When Galen grudgingly gave in, he created the coterie that bore his name. It soon became apparent to Prince Verity that the coterie, while internally cohesive, did not work well with the prince at all. By then, Galen had died, leaving Buckkeep with no successor to the post of Skillmaster. In desperation, Verity sought for others trained in the skill who might come to his aid. Although there had been no coteries created in the peaceful years of King Shrewd's reign, Verity reasoned that there might still live men and women trained for coteries before that. Had not the longevity of coterie members always been legendary? Perhaps he could find one who would either help him or be able to train others in the skill. But Prince Verity's efforts in this area availed him nothing. Those he could identify as skill users from records and word of mouth were all either dead or mysteriously vanished. So Prince Verity was left to wage his war alone. Before I could press Kettle to clarify her answers, there was a cry from Verity's tent. Every one of us jumped, but Kettle was the first to the tent flap. The fool emerged, gripping his left wrist in his right hand. He went straight to the water bucket and plunged in his hand. His face was contorted with either pain or fear, perhaps both. Kettle stalked after him to peer at the hand he gripped. She shook her head in disgust.
I warned you. Here. Take it out of the water. It won't do any good. Nothing will do it any good. Stop! Think about it. It's not really pain. It's just a sensation you've never felt before. Take a breath. Relax. Accept it. Accept it. Breathe deep. Breathe deep.
All the while she spoke, she tugged at the fool's arm until he reluctantly drew his hand from the water. Kettle immediately overset the bucket with her foot. She scruffed rock dust and gravel over the spilled water, all the while gripping the fool's arm. I craned my neck to peer past her. His first three fingers on his left hand were now tipped with silver. He looked at them with a shudder. I had never seen the fool so unnerved. Kettle spoke firmly.
It won't wash off. It won't wipe off. It's with you now, so accept it. Accept it!
Does it hurt? I asked anxiously.
Don't ask him that! Kettle snapped at me. Don't ask him anything just now. See to the king, Fitzchivalry, and leave the fool to me.
In my worry over the fool, I had all but forgotten my king. I stooped to enter the tent. Verity sat on two folded blankets. He was struggling to lace up one of my shirts. I deduced that Starling had ransacked all the packs to find clean clothes for him. It smote me to see him so thin that one of my shirts fit him. "Allow me, my king," I suggested. He not only dropped his hands away, he put them behind his back.
"Is the fool much hurt?"
he asked me, as I fought with the knotted strings. He sounded almost like my old Verity.
"Just three fingertips are silvered," I told him.
I saw that the fool had laid out a brush and thong. I stepped behind Verity and began to brush his hair back. He hastily snatched his hands around in front of him. Some of the grey in his hair had been rock dust, but not all. His warrior's queue was now grey with black streaks in it and coarse as a horse's tail. I struggled to smooth it back. As I tied the thong, I asked him,
"What does it feel like?"
"These?" he asked, holding up his hands and waggling the fingers.
"Oh, like skill. Only more so. And on my hands and arms."
I saw he thought he had answered my question.
"Why did you do it?"
I asked.
"Well, to work with the stone, you know. When this power is on my hands, the stone must obey the skill. Extraordinary stone. Like the witness stones in Buck, did you know that? Only they are not nearly as pure as what is here. Of course, hands are poor tools for working stone. But once you have cut away all the excess down to where the dragon waits, then he can be awakened with your touch. I draw my hands over the stone and recall to it the dragon, and all that is not dragon shivers away in shards and chips. Very slowly, of course. It took a whole day just to reveal his eyes."
"I see," I murmured at a loss. I did not know whether he was mad, or if I believed him. He stood up as far as he could in the low tent.
"Is Ketrickan angry with me?"
he asked abruptly.
"My lord king, it is not for me to say."
"Verity," he interrupted wearily.
"Call me Verity, and for Ida's sake, answer the question, Fitz."
He sounded so like his old self I wanted to embrace him. Instead, I said, "I do not know if she is angry. She is definitely hurt. She came a long and weary way to find you, bearing terrible news. And you did not seem to care."
"I care. When I think of it,"
he said gravely.
"When I think of it, I grieve. But there are so many things I must think of, and I cannot think of them all at once. I knew when the child died, Fitz. How could I not know? He too, and all I felt, I have put into the dragon."
He walked away slowly from me, and I followed him out of the tent. Outside he stood up straight, but did not lose the stoop in his shoulders. Verity was an old man now, far older than Chade somehow. I did not understand that, but I knew it was true. Ketrickan glanced up at his approach. She looked back into the fire, and then, almost unwillingly, she stood, stepping clear of the sleeping wolf. Kettle and Starling were binding the fool's fingers in strips of cloth. Verity went straight to Ketrickan and stood beside her.
"My queen," he said gravely, "if I could, I would embrace you. But you have seen that my touch..."
He gestured at the fool and let his words trail away. I had seen the look on her face when she had told Verity about the stillbirth. I expected her to turn aside from him, to hurt him as he had hurt her. But Ketrickan's heart was larger than that.
"Oh, my husband,"
she said, and her voice broke on the words. He held his silvered arms wide, and she came to him, taking him in her embrace. He bowed his grey head over the rough gold of her hair, but could not allow his hand to touch her. He turned his silvered cheek away from her. His voice was husky and broken as he asked her,
"Did you give him a name, our son?"
"I named him according to the customs of your land."
She took a breath. The word was so soft I scarce heard it.
"Sacrifice,"
she breathed. She clung to him tightly, and I saw his thin shoulders convulse in a sob.
Fitz!
Kettle hissed at me sharply. I turned to find her scowling at me.
Leave them alone, she whispered. Make yourself useful. Get a plate for the fool.
I had been staring at them. I turned away, shamed to have been gawking, but glad to see them embrace, even in sorrow. I did as Kettle had ordered, getting food for myself at the same time. I took the plate to the fool. He sat cradling his injured hand in his lap. He looked up as I sat beside him.
It doesn't rub off on anything else, he complained. Why did it cling to my fingers?
I don't know.
Because you're alive, Kettle said succinctly.
She sat down across from us, as if we needed supervising. Verity told me he can shape rock with his fingers, because of the skill on them, I told her.
Is your tongue hinged to the middle so that it flaps at both ends? You talk too much.
Kettle rebuked me. Perhaps I would not talk too much if you spoke a bit more, I replied. Rock is not alive. She looked at me.
You know that, do you? Well, what is the point of my talking when you already know everything?
She attacked her food as if it had done her a personal wrong. Starling joined us. She sat down beside me, her plate on her knees, and said, I don't understand about the silvery stuff on his hands. What is it? The fool snickered into his plate like a naughty child when Kettle glared at her. But I was getting tired of Kettle's evasions. What does it feel like? I asked the fool. He glanced down at his bandaged fingers.
Not much. Very sensitive. I can feel the wave of the threads in the bandages.
His eyes started to get distant. He smiled.
I can see the man who wove it, and I know the woman who spun it. The sheep on the hillside, rain falling on their thick wool, and the grass they ate. Wool is from grass, Fitz. A shirt woven from grass. No, there is more. The soil, black and rich and— Stop it! Kettle said harshly,
and she turned to me angrily.
And you stop asking him, Fitz, unless you want him to follow it too far and be lost forever.
She gave the fool a sharp poke.
Eat your food!
How is it that you know so much about the skill? Starling suddenly asked her.
Not you, too, Kettle angrily declared. Is there nothing private any more?
Among us, not much, the fool replied. But he was not looking at her. He was watching Ketrickin, her face still puffy from weeping, as she dished up food for herself and Verity. Her worn and stained clothing, her rough hair and chapped hands, and the simple, homely task she performed for her husband should have made her seem like any woman. But I looked at her and saw perhaps the strongest queen that Buckkeep had ever known. I watched Verity wince slightly as he took from her hand the simple wooden dish and spoon. He shut his eyes a moment, struggling against the pull of the implement's history. He composed his face and took a mouthful of food. Even across camp from him, I felt the sudden awakening of plain hunger. It was not just hot food he had been long without. It was solid sustenance of any kind. He took a shuddering breath and began to eat like a starved wolf. Kettle was watching him. A look of pity crossed her face.
No, very little privacy left for any of us, she said sadly.
The sooner we get him back to Jumpy, the sooner he can get better, Starling said smoothly. Should we start tomorrow, do you think? Or give him a few days of food and rest to rebuild his strength?
We shall not be taking him back to Jampe,
Kettle said, an undercurrent of sadness in her voice.
He has begun a dragon. He cannot leave it.
She looked around at us, levelly.
The only thing we can do for him now is stay here and help him finish.
With red ships torching the entire coastline of the Six Duchies and Pharaoh attacking the mountains, we should stay here and help the king carve a dragon? Starling was incredulous.
Yes. If we want to save the 6 duchies and the mountains, that is exactly what we should do. Now you will excuse me. I think I shall put on more meat to cook. Our king looks as if he could use it.
I set my empty plate aside. We should probably cook it all. In this weather, meat will sour fast. I unwisely said. I spent the next hour butchering the pig into portions that could dry cook, over the fire all night. Night-Eyes awoke and helped dispose of scraps until his belly was distended. Ketrickin and Verity sat talking quietly. I tried not to watch them, but even so I was aware that his gaze frequently strayed from her to the dais, where his dragon crouched over us. The low rumble of his voice was hesitant, and often died away altogether until prompted by another question from Ketrickin. The fool was amusing himself by touching things with his skill fingers, a bowl, a knife, the cloth of his shirt. He met Kettle's scowls with a benign smile.
"I'm being careful,"
he told her once.
"You have no idea of how to be careful," she complained. "You won't know you've lost your way until you're gone."
She got up from our butchery with a grunt and insisted on rebandaging his fingers. After that, she and Starling left together to get more firewood. The wolf got up with a groan and followed them. Ketrickin helped Verity into the tent. After a moment, she reappeared to go into the main tent. She emerged carrying her bedding. She caught my quick glance and abashed me by meeting my eyes squarely.
"I have taken your long mittens from your pack, Fitz," she told me calmly.
Then she joined Verity in the smaller tent. The fool and I looked everywhere except at each other. I went back to my cutting on the meat. I was tired of it. The smell of the pig was suddenly the smell of something dead rather than that of fresh meat, and I had smears of sticky blood up to my elbows. The worn cuffs of my shirt were soaked with it. I continued doggedly with my task. The fool came to crouch beside me.
"When my fingers brushed Verity's arm, I knew him," he said suddenly. "I knew he was a worthy king for me to follow, as worthy as his father before him. I know what he intends to do,"
he added in a lower voice.
"It was too much for me to grasp at first, but I have been sitting and thinking, and it fits in with my dream about Rielda."
A shiver ran through me that had nothing to do with chill. "What?" I demanded.
"The dragons are the elderlings," the fool said softly. "But Verity could not wake them. So he carves his own dragon, and when it is finished, he will waken it, and then he will go forth to fight the red ships. Alone."
Alone. That word struck me. Once again, Verity expected to fight the red ships. Alone. But there was too much I didn't quite grasp. "All the elderlings were dragons?" I asked. My mind went back to all the fanciful drawings and weavings of elderlings I had ever seen. Some had been dragon-like, but...
"No. The elderlings are dragons. Those carved creatures back in the stone garden. Those are the elderlings. King Wisdom was able to wake them in his time, to rouse them and recruit them to his cause. They came to life for him, but now they either sleep too deeply, or they are dead. Verity spent much of his strength trying to rouse them in every way he could think of. And when he could not, he decided that he would have to make his own elderling and quicken it, and use it to fight the red ships."
I sat stunned. I thought of the Whitlife both the wolf and I had sensed crawling through those stones. With a sudden pang, I remembered the trapped anguish of the girl on the dragon statue in this very quarry, living stone, trapped and flightless forever. I shuddered. It was a different kind of dungeon.
How is it done?
The fool shook his head.
I don't know. I don't think Verity knows himself. He blunders toward it, blind and groping. He shapes the stone. He gives it his memories, and when it is finished, it will come to life.
I suppose.
Do you hear what you are saying?
I asked him. Stone is going to rise and defend the 6 duchies from the red ships. And what of Regal's troops and the border skirmishes with the Mountain Kingdom? Will this dragon drive them off as well? Slow anger was building in me. This is what we have come all this way for a tale I would not expect a child to believe. The fool looked mildly affronted.
Believe it or not as you choose, but I know that Verity believes it. Unless I am much mistaken, Kettle believes it as well. Why else would she insist we must stay here and help Verity complete the dragon?
For a time I pondered this. Then I asked him, "Your dream about Rielda's dragon, what do you recall of it?" He gave a helpless shrug.
"The feelings of it, mostly. I was exuberant and joyful, for not only was I announcing Rielda's dragon, but he was also going to fly me on it. I felt I was a bit in love with him, you know? That sort of lift to the heart, but..."
He faltered.
"I cannot recall if I loved Rielda or his dragon. In my dream they are mingled, I think. Recalling dreams is so hard. One must seize them as soon as one awakes, and quickly repeat them to oneself, to harden the details. Otherwise they fade so quickly."
"But in your dream, did a stone dragon fly?"
"I was announcing the dragon in my dream, and knew I was to fly upon it. I had not yet seen it in my dream."
"Then maybe it has nothing to do at all with what Verity does. Perhaps, in the time from which your dream came, there were real dragons, of flesh and blood." He looked at me curiously.
"You do not believe there are real dragons today?"
"I have never seen one."
"In the city?"
he pointed out quietly. "That was a vision of a different time. You said today." He held one of his own pale hands up to the firelight.
"I think they are like my kind, rare, but not mythical. Besides, if there were no dragons of flesh and blood and fire, whence would come the idea for those stone carvings?"
I shook my head wearily. "This conversation goes in circles. I am tired of riddles and guesses and beliefs. I want to know what is real. I want to know why we came all this way and what it is we must do."
But the fool had no answers to that. When Kettle and Starling got back with the wood, he helped me layer the fire and arrange the meat where the heat would drive the fat from it. What meat we could not set to cook, we bundled aside in the pigskin. There was a sizable pile of bones and scraps. Despite how he had gorged earlier, Nighteye settled down with a leg bone to gnaw. I surmised he had regurgitated part of his bellyful somewhere.
"There is no such thing as having too much meat in reserve,"
he told me contentedly. I made a few attempts to needle Kettle into talking to me, but somehow it evolved into a lecture on how much more aware of the fool I must be now. He must be protected not only from Regal's coterie, but from the skill pull of objects that might take his mind wandering. For that reason, she wished us to stand our watches together. She insisted the fool must sleep on his back, his bared fingers upturned so they touched nothing. As the fool usually slept huddled in a ball, he was not overly pleased. But at last, we settled for the night. I was not due to take my watch until the hours before dawn, but it was short of that when the wolf came to push his nose under my cheek and jog my head until I opened my eyes.
"What?"
I demanded tiredly.
"Ketrickin walks alone, weeping."
I doubted she would want my company. I also doubted that she should be alone. I rose noiselessly and followed the wolf out of the tent. Outside, Kettle sat by the fire, poking disconsolately at the meat. I knew she must have seen the Queen leave, so I did not dissemble. I'm going to go find Ketrickan.
Probably a good idea, she said quietly. She told me she was going to look at his dragon. But she has been gone longer than that.
We needed to say no more about it. I followed Night Eyes as he trotted purposefully away from the fire. But he led me not toward Verity's dragon, but back through the quarry. There was little moonlight, and what there was, the looming black blocks of stone seemed to drink away. Shadows seemed to fall in all different directions, altering perspective. The need for caution made the quarry vast as I picked my way along the wolf's wake. My skin prickled as I realized we were going in the direction of the pillar. But we found her before we reached there. She was standing, motionless as the stone itself, by the girl on the dragon. She had clambered up onto the back of stone that mired the dragon, and reached up to lay a hand on the girl's leg. A trick of the moonlight made it look as if the girl's stone eyes looked down on her. Light sparkled silver on a stone tear, and glistened in the tears on Ketrickan's face. Night Eyes padded lightly up, leaped weightlessly upon the dais, and leaned his head against Ketrickan's leg with a tiny whine.
Hush, she told him softly. Listen. Can you hear her weeping? I can.
I did not doubt it, for I could feel her questing out with the wit more strongly than I had ever sensed it from her before. M'lady, I said quietly. She startled, her hand flying to her mouth as she turned to me. I beg your pardon, I did not mean to frighten you. But you should not be out here alone. Kettle fears there may still be danger from the coterie, and we are not so far from the pillar. She smiled bitterly.
Wherever I am alone. Nor can I think of anything they could do to me worse than what I have done to myself.
That is only because you do not know them as well as I do. Please, my queen, come back to the camp with me. She moved, and I thought she would step down to me. Instead, she sat down and leaned back against the dragon. My wit sense of the dragon girl's misery was echoed by Ketrickan's.
I just wanted to lie beside him, she said quietly, to hold him and to be held. To be held, Fitz. To feel not safe, I know none of us are safe, but to feel valued, loved. I did not expect more than that, but he would not. He said he could not touch me, that he dared not touch anything live save his dragon.
She turned her head aside.
Even with his hands and arms gloved. He would not touch me.
I found myself clambering up the dais. I took her by the shoulders and drew her to her feet.
He would if he could,
I told her.
This I know. He would if he could.
She lifted her hands to cover her face, and her silent, sliding tears suddenly became sobs. She spoke through them.
You, and your skill, and him, you speak so easily of knowing what he feels, of love, but I don't have that, I am only. I need to feel it, Fitz, I need to feel his arms about me, to be close to him, to believe he loves me as I love him, after I have failed him in so many ways. How can I believe, when he refuses to even...
I put my arms about her, and drew her head down on my shoulder, while Night Eyes leaned up against both of us, and keened softly.
He loves you,
I told her.
He does.
But fate has laid this burden upon both of you. It must be borne.
Sacrifice,
she breathed. And I did not know if she named her child, or defined her life. She continued to weep, and I held her, soothing her hair and telling her it would get better. It would be better some day. There would be a life for them when all this was over, and children, children growing up safe from red ships or Regal's evil ambitions. In time, I felt her quiet, and realized it was wit as much as words I had been giving her. The feeling I had for her had mingled with the wolf's and joined us. Gentler than a skill bond, more warm and natural, I held her in my heart, as much as in my arms. Night-Eyes pressed up against her, telling her he would guard her, that his meal would ever be her meal, that she need fear nothing that had teeth, for we were pack, and always would be. It was she who finally broke the embrace. She gave a final shuddering sigh and then stepped apart from me. Her hand rose to smear the wetness on her cheeks.
"Oh, Fitz,"
she said simply, sadly. And that was all. I stood still, feeling the chill apartness where for a time we had been together. A sudden pang of loss assaulted me, and then a shiver of fear as I realized its source. The girl on the dragon had shared our embrace, her wit misery briefly consoled by our closeness. Now, as we drew apart, the far, chill wailing of the stone rose up again, louder and stronger. I tried to leap lightly down from the dais, but as I landed, I staggered and nearly fell. Somehow that joining had drawn strength from me. It was frightening. But I masked my uneasiness as I silently accompanied Ketrickin back to the camp. I was just in time to relieve Kettle on watch. She and Ketrickin went to sleep, promising to send the fool out to stand watch with me. The wolf gave me an apologetic glance and then followed Ketrickin into the tent. I assured him I approved. A moment later the fool emerged, rubbing his eyes with his left hand and carrying his right lightly curled against his chest. He took a seat on a stone across from me, and I looked over the meat to see which pieces needed turning. For a time, he watched me silently. Then he stopped, and with his right hand picked up a piece of firewood. I knew I should rebuke him, but instead I watched, as curious as he. After a moment, he tucked the wood into the fire and straightened.
"Quiet and lovely," he told me. "Some 40 years of growing, winter and summer, storm and fair weather. And before that it was born as a nut by another tree. And so the thread goes back over and over. I do not think I need fear much from natural things, only those that have been wrought by man. Then the threads go raveling out. But trees, I think, will be pleasant to touch."
"Kettle said you should touch no live things," I reminded him like a tattling child.
"Kettle has not to live with this. I do. I must discover the limits it places on me. The sooner I find what I can and cannot do with my right hand, the better."
He grinned wickedly,